The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation. On MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hi, this is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. We try to post as much inspirational stories as possible, as much good news as possible, as much about people overcoming adversity, current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, and relationships. And today is no exception. We have Mark Shulman visiting with us. He is with his family in Tel Aviv as we speak, and we are talking on Thursday, July 24th. You're how many hours, let's see, 10 hours ahead of us, Mark, here in Los Angeles?
Correct.
Okay, so if you're downloading this later, we wanted to give you a context of where our conversation is happening and what's happening at the moment with the situation as Israel. Mark has his bachelor's and his master's from Columbia University. His master's is in political science, and his specialization is in the Middle East. He's lived in Israel at different times for a total of 12 years, and you served as an officer in the Israeli Air Force when you were a younger man, and now you're there and you're talking about and posting about, because you even had an article, I believe it was yesterday in Newsweek, about what's going on. So I really want you to know how much we appreciate you taking the time, Mark, and thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Maria.
So tell us your history with Israel, because before we started the program, you told me that you've lived there off and on since the past 2 decades or so, or 40 decades.
Four decades, I guess. 40 decades, yes. Gee.
Yeah,
I'd really be old at this point.
Pardon me.
Sure. I was closely attached to Israel all my life. My parents were Zionists who met in, which was the organization that was created to found the State of Israel. There were American Zionists who met in that organization. I first moved to Israel after graduating Columbia in 1975. I enlisted in the Israeli Army and ended up in the Air Force, spent a number of years there as an Air Force officer and not as a pilot, and then spent a number of years additionally in Israel, and then ended up coming back to the United States for a number of years, got my master's at Columbia, did some teaching, taught at SUNY, and ended up back in Israel for another few years, and then back in the United States for quite a number of years, and finally, 3 years ago, we came back. My middle daughter, I was turning 18. She had been born in Israel, and she had the opportunity of getting out of it, but theoretically was responsible to go into the Israeli Army at that point at the age of 18. She graduated high school and decided to do so. And I had been what's called here a lone soldier, a soldier who does not have parents with them in the country, and I didn't want her to do the same thing. And so we came back, and we've been here for 3 years at this point.
Now, how do you go back and forth like that? Do you have domiciles in both places, or you just rent and go back and forth so that you can stay as long as you need, not knowing how long that will be?
Well, we've been renting. We've never put down roots, probably because of that. Every time we went back to the States, it was going to be for a shorter period of time. We ended up being there longer. My business, primarily in the way I earn my money, is I develop apps. Apps mostly in history for iPhone, iPad, and I've been doing related type of digital work for many years. I have a very large website, so my location is not all that crucial. Mm-hmm. So that gives me the flexibility to be pretty much anywhere in the world and earn the same living. It has no impact on my income in terms of where I am. Of course, these last couple of weeks have not been very productive weeks in terms of income, but that just relates to the events of the last few weeks. So I can be back and forth if I'm in the United States or if I'm in Israel, or frankly, if I'm traveling somewhere else, it really has no impact because I can submit to the App Store wherever I am. We have people who work for us, but they all work in different parts of the world, so it really doesn't make any difference.
So the ultimate international telecommuting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Mark, were your folks born in the United States?
My mother was born in Germany and came to the United States in 1936 at the age of 9. My father was born in the United States. His parents came to the United States when they were 4 years old. So on one side, I'm third generation. On the other side, I'm second.
So they meet with the Zionist cause, and that obviously must have fueled all kinds of levels of their relationship. And then they instill that on you. And then you go back and forth. Now, do you speak Yiddish in Israel?
Or Hebrew.
Hebrew, so
yes.
Pardon me for that.
I'm fluent in Hebrew. I you know, I'm bad at languages, quite frankly. I almost flunked out of high school French, but I've been doing this for so long in terms of Hebrew, I'll never get rid of my accent, but otherwise I'm 100% fluent. I can speak in Hebrew. I give speeches in Hebrew. Writing is always comes a little more difficult. I send texts and emails in Hebrew, but I wouldn't write a long letter in Hebrew. Too many grammatical mistakes here and there when I write. But I make grammatical mistakes in English too, so I guess that's just part of it.
Yeah. Now, were you raised speaking Hebrew in your family?
No, my parents didn't really speak Hebrew. I went to Jewish day schools where I learned Hebrew. Didn't learn it very well because, like I said, I'm a poor language learner. I only really got to speak Hebrew when I started working for some Israeli organizations when I was in college, and then had to actually speak it on a day-to-day basis. And of course, once I came to Israel and when I went into the army, of course, there's no choice but to speak Hebrew. And so at that point, my Hebrew became fluent, and it's remained so to the rest of my life. So that gives me the ease of moving back, going back and forth. And it also gives me the ability to do, a reasonable job these days reporting on the Israeli society and understanding what's going on here, because I'm a native speaker in the sense that I can fully understand all of the different aspects and can hear someone's voice and tell what they're saying, even if they're not saying it. Let's put it that way.
Oh, interesting. Reading between the lines.
Especially on Israeli news broadcasts, which are often clouded by censorship sometimes, you can read things in if you listen very carefully.
So how would you describe your day-to-day existence now? Because in the article that I read from Newsweek that was published yesterday on July 23rd, you talk about your nightly bicycle ride.
Yes. Well, I mean, since I work primarily out of the house, and I mean, my day is really pretty much involved in working on whichever app I happen to be working on, or doing whatever writing that I'm doing on any particular day. I'm the kind of sort of person who goes back and forth between different projects until the project is 95%. And then when it's 95%, then I put all out effort on that one project. Obviously, right now, things are a little bit different. I used to be putting out a daily update to my own website on what's going on in Israel. The daily was usually 3 or 4 times a week. Now it's every single day. And for at least the last week or 10 days, I guess it's almost 10 days now, I've had a daily column in Newsweek. So I've paid more attention to that side of my life and try to spend some time going out and speaking to people. My nightly bicycle ride is something I've been doing since I'm here. I go out every night around midnight. It's primarily for exercise, and it's a good chance to really get out. And so Tel Aviv is a city that is up late, let's put it that way. My daughter, when she goes out with friends, she's 21, but you know, from the time she was here, when she goes out with friends, she goes out at 11 o'clock, and that's pretty typical for Israelis. So Tel Aviv is a very late night city. So I enjoy going out at midnight, take my bicycle ride, and meet people, talk to people often late at the night. That's an unusual sort of thing. But I work mostly from the home. You know, these days I have the television on all the time. The Israeli television stations have moved to 100% news all the time from 6 a.m. in the morning until midnight at night. It's news now, 100%. There's no other programming whatsoever during this war.
Really?
Yep. Now, at least, I mean, there's some of the cable channels, there's some dramas and those, but the regular, the three main television stations which Israel has, you know, the equivalent of ABC, CBS, and NBC in the United States, are now 100% news from first thing in the morning until last thing at night.
And of course, so if you're talking about your daughter going out, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and your nightly bicycle ride in the city of Tel Aviv, that would suggest that you feel that you have some kind of safety.
Right. Well, the reality is, on a personal level, personal safety, Tel Aviv has always been an extremely safe city. There are no issues going out at midnight, never a question. My daughter going out at night, I never worry about her safety, and especially since we live in downtown of a city. She also doesn't have a car to drive home in, and so I don't have to worry about those sort of things that I'm sure parents in your listening area worry about a great deal in the middle of the night. So in terms of personal safety, I'm never worried. These last 2 weeks, of course, or 3 weeks almost, there is the other issue of the rocket attacks. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that interrupts the day in all sorts of ways. This morning, we were listening to the news, and I was working, and I said, well, there's some good news this morning. Things were looking up. The airlines, at least the FAA, had rescinded its order not to fly to Israel. Israel had gotten 150 prisoners this morning. It was sort of like, things are really looking up. And then the sirens went off. And that meant there was another missile attack, and we all rushed to our safe area. And a minute and a half later, we could hear the explosions over our head. And that meant the missiles had been intercepted and blown up in the sky, but literally in the sky over our heads. So that's just not normal, obviously. And because the Israeli anti-missile system has been so effective, people are not really worried about their safety on a day-to-day level in that sense. I mean, you want to make sure you're not out in the open, because what happens when a missile explodes above you and gets blown up is that the pieces of it come down. And sometimes they're relatively large pieces, so you don't want to be out in the open. And so you make sure you're not out in the open. And one of the things you make sure about is you don't go somewhere where you can't be under shelter in 1 minute. So for instance, usually on Saturday mornings, for instance, I usually bicycle to a beach, about a 25-minute bicycle ride from my home, and then walk along the beach. But I haven't done that in a couple of weeks because there's absolutely no place to find shelter there if one would need to. So there's that sort of, it changes life in all sorts of ways. You go somewhere and you're always looking, well, which house can I run into? Where can I go if the sirens go off? And of course, I don't think I've taken my blood pressure since this has all begun. There's just this thing of any particular moment, suddenly the sirens can go off. I'm pretty comfortable doing it at midnight. The sirens have never gone off after 10:30 at night. So at least they're, maybe the Hamas people go to sleep as well at some point.
Now, can you give us what are the parameters for a siren going off? It means that it's going to that something has been fired and been detected, and it's imminent. It's with its arrival within, like you said, a minute, or what is?
It's a minute and a half.
What triggers it?
It's a minute and a half from Tel Aviv. The way the system works is it's very, very accurate. So, for instance, this morning, first there was a series of sirens, and there were no sirens, but there was the alerts on the television where it showed the different areas. And one of the area was probably no more than a mile and a half from our house, but the sirens did not go off in our area. And one of the interesting things in this case, I actually was able to watch an intercept out my window because it was taking place over a neighboring town. But then just after that was over, they set another volley, and this one headed towards Tel Aviv itself. And in this case, the sirens went off in Tel Aviv. It means there was about, like I said, a minute and a half until the missile would theoretically land on top of you or in your area, or be intercepted. Now, in this case, and in almost every single case that a missile has been sent towards the center of the country, every single one of them has been intercepted. So in that sense, there is that comfort level that it is going to be intercepted. I was here during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War in 1990, when Saddam Hussein was firing Scud missiles at Israel. And then there was just nothing to do. He fired a missile at Tel Aviv. You didn't know where it was going to land, and there was absolutely nothing to try to do. The United States had its Patriot missiles here, but they were not really effective. So you just hoped the missile wouldn't hit your place and, of course, go into a bomb shelter. This is a completely different feeling because you know there's an active defense working to defend you. As a matter of fact, one of the girls or women, however you want to define it, 20-year-old woman who was an immigrant, a lone soldier, actually, she got off and she was with us Friday night and a friend of the family. And she's one of those people who was at one of the missile batteries making sure they fire and bring down the missile. So
they're actually armed with human beings.
Right. I mean, they're human beings who work
the anti-missile.
Right. I mean, it's a computer system. The way the anti-missile system works is a very sophisticated radar system guided by computers, calculates every time a launch takes place from Gaza. It very quickly calculates what sort of missile it is, and it's able to calculate with amazing accuracy where it's liable to land. It then concludes whether that missile is likely to land in an open field, in an open area, in which case it does not send a missile to intercept. And if it's likely to hit an area that is populated, then it sends a missile to intercept. If it's in the Tel Aviv metro area, it usually sends two missiles to make sure it successfully downs the missile. And that's how it works. There are people who have to actually decide whether it's okay to fire the missile, that everything's all clear. And, of course, the people have to work the area. They have to reload the systems. They have to make sure they work properly. So there's a crew of 20-odd people for each missile system to make sure that everything works well.
And historically, since you have that perspective of 40 years, what is your sense about what's going on now versus what has happened in the past?
Well, it's both very similar and very different. I mean, very much similar is the sense, and I was just talking to two sets of friends who I've known here and there for 40 odd years. And we were talking in the last 2 days about the fact that, you know, we were young and we were optimistic and we thought that anything was possible. And certainly in our lifetime, there would be peace and we wouldn't worry about such things. And now we're 40 years later. And one of the things I remember and I talk about is when I was in the Army 40 years ago, meeting a soldier whose father had fought in the War of Independence in this country, which took place in 48 and 49, and thinking to myself, I've got to make sure that my children never have to be in the Army and fight in a war. And of course, I have two children already who have gone through the Army and are no longer in the Army. My friend who I was talking to already has a grandchild who's 10 years old. So in that sense, there's a great deal of frustration, sadness, you know, the sense that it keeps on going on. It's doesn't end. We can't seem to find a solution. There's no way that the Palestinians seem to be willing to ultimately make peace with us. That's one level of the frustration. Of course, the country is very different. I mean, the very fact that we have an active missile system that defends us, and we're the only country in the world with a deployed anti-missile system that's deployed to defend the country, defend the cities. And as you know, we have three different types of anti-missile systems. Two of them are already deployed. Another one is going to be deployed in the next 6 months. And even a fourth system, which is a laser-based system, is being tested. So that's, you know, almost Star Wars-like. It's a different country altogether. When I first came here 40 years ago, this was very much a third-world country in every which way. Everything from the toilet paper that was more like cardboard to the food that was difficult to eat. Today, I mean, it's in every which way like being in the United States. Tel Aviv is very much like being in Manhattan, quite frankly, in terms of the restaurants, in terms of everything that's here, in terms of technology. I mean, it's the second place after Silicon Valley in terms of the number of startups. I'm not by percentage, but in absolute numbers. So you have a tremendous amount of high tech and technology and all those sort of things. It's a different place in all that ways. And yet, despite all of the high tech, despite all of these things, it's the ground soldiers that are being forced to go in and find tunnels to blow up and risk their lives. So everything changes and everything remains the same. You know, sometimes it feels like Groundhog Day and sometimes it feels like, wow, I can't believe all this has happened.
And are you an American citizen?
Yes, I'm both an American citizen and an Israeli citizen.
Okay, so give us your perspective on what's going on with the leaders of the United States and the politics as you see it.
Okay, I mean, there are two different levels to look at it. I mean, there's the narrow America-Israel level, and there's the greater level in terms of this, the American administration and foreign policy in the last few years. And I'll start on the higher level. And to be honest, before I go any further, I voted for President Obama. So Okay. Just, you know, make that clear on one level. And yet I've been terribly, terribly disappointed in the poor implementation of foreign policy in the last couple of years. Misreading of the situation, hoping the world is going to be the way he would like it to be as opposed to the way the world really is. I've seen way too much of an attempt to counterbalance the overextension of American power during the Bush years and a sense of pulling back that may very much reflect the will of the American people, but it's not the responsibility of the American president to reflect the wills of the people. It's the responsibility of the American president to lead the people and to try to move them into places where they may not quite be comfortable, but explain to them why it's necessary. So on the very large level, I've been very concerned because I don't believe there's a replacement for American power in the world. Unless we want to, you know, we want the Chinese to become to replace us, but there is nobody else who can take America's place as the global power. There's no one else who has aircraft carriers in all oceans and really has a blue water navy, that has an armed forces that can easily move from place to place and be transported and everything else like that. So on the global level, I'm very concerned about the actions the United States has taken. The mistakes that have been made, particularly the mistake over Syria, creating a red line and then letting the Syrians walk right over the red line. I've been concerned about the actions vis-a-vis the Ukrainians. I spent the week and a half in Poland about a month and a half ago, and saw the fear in the Poles and fear that the United States wouldn't stand up for the people of Europe at this point. And we've seen since then really a lot of vacillation. Now, the Europeans have vacillated as well, so it's not all America's fault. And then on the issue of the Middle East, I mean, it's this strange thing to have strange contacts with, I mean, more than contacts, but looking upon Turkey as a natural friend in the Middle East these days. Turkey that has moved far into the Islamic camp. Qatar, who's also the most radical of all Arab states at the moment. So I see a real miss there. But history has had a miss. I mean, look at what happened in Egypt in the last 2 years, the ups and downs there. America's sort of been on the wrong side of that as well. So that's on the larger level. And that's a concern for me in my hat as an American and an American historian, because most of what I write about is American history. So that's one level. When I look upon it in terms of Israel and the United States and the bilateral relations, I can understand where there'd be some friction on a personal level. I can't think of two leaders more dissimilar than President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu. And Netanyahu comes with strong connections to the Republican Party, has made those connections very clear. So there isn't a lot of great personal love lost between them. Beyond that, I mean, on one hand level, the United States has remained a great friend of Israel, has supported Israel in all sorts of ways. On the other hand, there's this sense, there's certainly a sense these days, and there was a sense certainly yesterday when the FAA decision was made, or 2 days ago when the FAA decision was made on Tuesday, initially, to stop all flights to Israel. And that was sort of a gut punch here, that the FAA was going to give the terrorists a win. Now, there was a reason for it. There was a missile that actually was not intercepted, and it landed probably a mile and a half, 2 miles from the airport, which was a little bit close for comfort. And I understand that reaction. And I understood the reaction that a bureaucrat could make a decision. But yesterday, when it was renewed, yesterday on Wednesday, it was like, okay, it's no longer a bureaucrat. It's a decision that was made by the government, and this is a mistake. And, of course, this morning, which was Thursday morning, Israel time, I guess about midnight, Wednesday night, Thursday, New York, East Coast time, the FAA changed its mind. I guess political pressure actually did work in this case. To allow flights again to Israel. Uh-huh. Which, if the flight stopping was going to be the greatest victory that Hamas had gotten, I mean, we sort of forget, and this, I mean, even in Israel sometimes we forget it, and certainly in the United States people forget it all the time, that whether you consider how important you consider Palestinian rights and the need for a two-state solution, I'm one of those people who believes very strongly in a two-state solution. Hamas, however, are terrorists in every which way. They're responsible for more deaths and destruction than almost any other terrorist organization. They single-handedly destroyed initial attempts at peace between Israel and the Palestinians, and they're simply a terrorist organization. And to even talk about supporting Hamas and to talk about giving them aid and all of these other things, I mean, it's an absurdity. The United States shouldn't be any which way in that direction. And, you know, in the last day or two, it seems Secretary of State Kerry, under President Obama's instructions, is more interested than anyone else in getting a ceasefire and getting Israel to make concessions to Hamas. And Hamas should not get a victory in this case in any which way. So I find that all very problematic.
You're talking about the 5-day temporary ceasefire that Secretary of State John Kerry is suggesting.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's
right.
Correct, which is a very problematic ceasefire, because what it says is, we'll have a 5-day temporary ceasefire and then we'll negotiate. And if the negotiations don't work out, then Hamas can begin firing again. So let's give Hamas 5 days to resupply their troops, to move their troops around. We now know where the Israelis are located. It's a ridiculous idea, quite frankly. Israel's willing to have a truce, no question. It's accepted two truces, but both of them were supposed to be permanent truces, not a temporary truce. The temporary truce is just a way of preparing for the next rounds instead of in a couple of years, in a couple of weeks. And it's like this desperate effort that, you know, that's the way it looks like here. It looks like Secretary of State Kerry is looking like someplace he can do something, and he can't do anything in anywhere else So we decided to do it here. So that's really really a great deal of frustration amongst Israelis at this point, is that sense. Now, don't get me wrong. Almost every Israeli is looking for this war to end. No one wants this war to keep on going very much longer. It's difficult. You know, it's on one hand, first of all, it's difficult because we've lost a fairly large number of soldiers at this point. But on a different level, you know, I described briefly what it was like for the when the sirens go off. But this has been going on, you know, from the south in much greater extent. But Tel Aviv metropolitan area, you're talking about 17 days. You know, 17 days where kids are suddenly have to run to shelters and run all sorts of places and hear sirens going off, sirens that no one has heard in Tel Aviv in 20 years. So it's a difficult time, and it has an impact that people don't understand, and a cumulative impact. So Israelis want this to end. There's no question. But Israelis do not want this to end in terms that will help Hamas, and that will make Hamas feel like they've had a victory. After all, this was not a war that Israel began. This was a war that Hamas decided to begin. Israel believed, mistakenly, it was a failure of Israeli intelligence, a failure of American intelligence, the failure of everybody. Everybody said in the weeks and the days before this began that it's in Hamas's interest not to go to war. They're not going to be interested in another war with Israel. Well, lo and behold, they kept on shelling Israel, firing missiles at Israel. Israel gave them 48 hours and extended that by another 24 hours. And eventually, when the 72 hours were over, the Hamas fired a round of 30, I think it was 40 missiles at areas in the Tel Aviv metropolitan area. That was their answer to the fact that Israel said, stop, please, before we have to do something. And then, of course, at that point, Israel had no choice but to respond. So this is a war that Hamas began, and they began to achieve certain political goals, and it would be a great mistake on everyone's part to allow a group of terrorists who began a war to dictate the terms of the ceasefire. And of course, you know, it's a very problematic war, to say the least. It's asymmetric. I mean, there's no question if Israel wanted to practice what the United States did in World War II, there would be, you know, Gaza would be leveled last week. And quite honestly, I was one of those people when Israel pulled out unilaterally from Gaza, and that was about 9 years ago, I was one of those people who said, let's pull out. It's not a problem. And if they fire as much as one shell on us, now that they're free and independent of us and we have no troops there, then we have every right to level the place. Well, at this point, obviously, we can't level the place. We have to worry about civilian casualties, which I understand. But it puts us in a very strange situation. I mean, can you imagine what would be going on if San Diego was being rocketed from Tijuana every day? You know, 10 rockets landed, including one outside the San Diego Naval Base. How long would it take before American troops had occupied all of Tijuana and was on the way to Mexico City?
So in a perfect world, Mark, what can you suggest should happen? What should be aspired to?
Okay, a perfect world. That's an interesting term after 40 years. Look, I'm someone who does believe in a two-state solution. I'm one of those people who goes all the way back to history. In 1936, there was a commission by the British government to look into what to do with Palestine. And in 1936, they came up with a partition plan between a small Jewish state and a larger Arab state. The Jews accepted it. That was before the Holocaust. And if there had been a Jewish state in 1936, the situation may have been very different in Europe in the early 40s. But the Arabs rejected it. In 1947, the United Nations Commission on Palestine made a similar suggestion, and this time the Jewish state was bigger. And once again, the Jews accepted it, the Arabs didn't, and war is what ensued. And that's how we ended up with a small Jewish state and an even smaller area that became Palestinian, but it wasn't Palestinian. It was occupied by Jordan and by Egypt, the Gaza Strip by Egypt, and the West Bank by Jordan. I still believe in the two-state solution. I believe in the partition of the two lands. I am not convinced, frankly, that the Palestinians to this day are willing to accept that partition. And we have this problem of the refugees that were created after the 1947 war. At the time, there were 600,000. Today, there are 5 million people who claim to be refugees. And it's the only refugee population in the world that all you need to have is one great-grandparent who was a refugee, and you're considered a refugee as well. In the creation of India and Pakistan in 1947, at the exact same time, there were 100 million refugees created between Hindus and Muslims who basically had to exchange places. The end result there, of course, is there are no refugees from that war today. And at the end of World War II, there were 50 million refugees in Europe. Same thing, there are no refugees in Europe today because they were resettled. So we need to deal with that. The Palestinians have to give up with their idea that they're going to return to what was pre-1967 Israel. I'm not sure they're willing to do that, but that is the solution. That there is a separate Palestinian state, a state that's disarmed, but a separate state, Palestinian state and a Jewish state. I'm just not convinced the Palestinians are willing to accept that, and we have Jews who are not willing to accept that either. We have religious people on both sides of the world, and at both sides of the divide, quite frankly. You have eerily similar religiosity, where you have on the Jewish side people who believe that God gave the whole land of Israel to the Jews, and on the Palestinian side, you have people who believe in the Islamic view, Dar al-Islam, a part of Islam that was once Islamic must always remain Islamic. So therefore, the state of Israel can't become a Jewish state because it must be a Muslim state. So we have that, and I'm not sure how we overcome that. You know, 40 years ago, like I said, I was optimistic we'd find a way to overcome it sometime in my lifetime. At this point, I'm really not that optimistic that it'll take place in my lifetime, and I hope to live quite a long life yet, but I'm still not convinced of that.
If we took Hamas out of the equation, would that make you more optimistic?
Yes, it would certainly make you more optimistic. They're the extreme group. They're the group that has not been willing to accept the existence of Israel under any terms. They're the ones who say they're against the partition, they only want all of Palestine. But getting rid of Hamas is two separate actions. I mean, there's getting rid of the political and military Hamas currently in Gaza, and there's getting rid of the idea of Hamas, which is a deeper idea. And so one of the things one has to look at is, you know, you need to have a situation where the Palestinian people as a whole, A, accept the idea of partition, accept once and for all that the land that is Israel is Israel, land that is Jewish, and the land that is Arab will be Arab and part of a Palestinian state. And that those refugees that are out there, they'll have a choice of being resettled somewhere in the world or going back to the Palestinian state and not to the homes that they've kept the key to in Jaffa and Haifa and other such places. So you need to get to that place. You need to get to the place where the most extreme person does not have a veto over any solution. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, one of the problems. I mean, we look upon all over the world, and when the most extreme view is the one that gets to decide, we end up not making any progress. And, you know, we see that. Look in different parts of the Middle East. We see the people with the guns, the most extreme extremists, are the ones that stand between civilization, between countries moving forward and countries falling back into middle-aged-like conflict.
Ideology.
Yes.
Right. So what can we do to help, depending on what side of the conversation the listeners are on? What do you suggest?
Okay. First, really be educated. And the most important thing is whatever side of the conversation you think you are on, whatever view you hold, read a book, read some articles of somebody else, the other side. Because one of the greatest problems, and this goes obviously beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, this goes back to any area of politics or disagreement, is we all live within our own bubbles. And we hear our own propaganda, and we believe our own propaganda, and there's no other side to it. And in order for any chance for us ever to reach any sort of agreement on the bigger questions, we need to understand the other side. There are two rights here. I mean, there's no two rights here in terms of Hamas. Hamas is just terrorists, period. No offense or buts. But when you look at the overall Palestinian question, there are two rights here. There are two people who have a connection to the land, two people who deserve to have their own states in every which way. And so therefore, if you're Jewish and you care about Israel, at least understand that the Palestinian side of things. If you're, you know, anybody who cares about Israel, understand there is another side. The Palestinians do have some rights, and I would have, you know, some concerns. But on the other side of it, to all those people who are incredibly critical of Israel, understand the other side of it. Understand the fact that Israel never wanted conflict from the very beginning. and try to understand that and try to understand the history of the state of Israel and what developed. And, you know, you can't, one of the interesting things, and this is such a problem we have in all over the world, particularly in the United States, we don't like learning about history. We sort of think that everything began last week. And it didn't. I don't care what subject matter, whatever subject matter you want to discuss in current events, you need to look at the history of it. You need to look back. How did we get here? I mean, we talk about, in the case of Gaza, we talk about, well, all this has to happen is Israel has to remove its blockade of Gaza. Well, excuse me, why is there a blockade of Gaza? That's because they started firing missiles on Israel. We'd be happy if they agreed never to fire any more missiles and keep their word. There'd never be a blockade on Gaza. But when Israel moved out of Gaza, it was the hope that it would become the Singapore of the Middle East or the Hong Kong of the Middle East. So, you know, we forget about history. And that's really important. Look at the history. Understand the history. That's the most important thing. Educate yourself on the history. And I say this generally speaking to Americans, and not only on the Arab-Israeli conflict. America may exist from ocean to ocean. It may in many ways still be the strongest country on earth, but we live in an ever more interconnected, interrelated world. Mm-hmm. My son, who's 14, has friends in every corner of the earth, almost literally. He can be up at any time of the day or night, and he's talking to programmers in different parts of the world and working with different ones on different projects. The next age, the next generation is growing up in that world that is totally interconnected. And if we're going to live in an interconnected world and be successful, you've got to know about the rest of the world. You've got to know about the history of China. You've got to know about the history of Europe. You've got to know about the history of different parts of the world and the issues that are important. You can't remain ignorant, because ignorance breeds fear. And you can't be fearful in a world that is so interconnected.
That's well said, because I always say that knowledge is power, and that you do need to know what the other side is thinking or knows to be their truth to have an understanding of the perspective of the people involved, whether you agree with them or not.
Absolutely. It's the most important thing. And even if you want to disagree with them, or you want to fight them, I don't mean physically, but if you want to fight them in terms of propaganda or in lectures or in debates, you need to understand them in order to do it effectively.
Right. Well, Mark, I hope that this is not our last visit. I appreciate you taking your time and your expertise and your wisdom and the risks as well.
I'm glad we weren't interrupted by a siren. I was wondering what I was going
to
do
too.
With the sirens going off.
I was thinking the same thing. So we'll leave that to our next conversation, and hopefully that will never happen.
Yeah, I hope so.
So, Mark, we will post the link to your blog, basically, right, on historycentral.com/Israel/daily. And I look forward to having a conversation again with you, Mark.
My pleasure. And you can look for my column every day in Newsweek as well.
Perfect. And continued success to you, and continued security to you and your family.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Thank you, Mark Shulman. And this is Maria Sanchez. Thank you for listening, and hoping you're helping to make this world a better place.
Talking, so call Maria. Her show is killer. You won't believe it, darling. There's long time listeners.